This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
So please just raise a hand if I start to speak too quietly and you can't hear me, okay? So I'd like to start with gratitude, a practice of gratitude. First of all, thank you to Abbot Myo for having me here, inviting me, and thank you to Joseph for his role in that as well. And to my teachers, Shosan Victoria Austin and Seke Harada Roshi. So, thinking about my topic for today, I picked a perennial. I picked the topic of feeling busy, a seemingly never-ceasing aspect of modern life. Maybe you feel like you have a lot of chores to do, or maybe you feel that emails are piling up in your inbox, or texts are coming across your phone constantly. Or maybe you live a very peaceful life, relaxed life, and then you need to get out of the house and you can't find your keys or the shoes that you wanted to wear, and suddenly you're in a hurry to make it to your appointment. And then there is the aspect of busyness in this culture that can sometimes be a way of feeling good about ourselves. I'm productive if I'm busy and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing in this society. I'm worth something if I'm busy. But there can be this feeling of overwhelm or this feeling of pressure. And maybe you start to have the thought, I don't have time for that. Even when the that is something that you really want to do, like answer the phone when your loved one calls, or like clearing a space on your desk, or like making time to be here this morning. So I want to thank each and every one of you who are here this morning for taking care of your life in this way. But there are the times when you feel perhaps like you can't take care of it in this way, and I want to talk a little bit about that. And in particular, I want to talk a little bit about what Zen Master Dogen from Mount Ehe has to say about such a thing. So most of you here might know that he is a 13th century Japanese monk who founded the tradition of this particular temple and several temples here in the city. And what Dogen had to say about it was particularly inscribed in a fascicle called Uji, or being time. That's those two characters in Japanese means being time, Uji, written in about 1240 AD. And Dogen says in that fascicle, you fail to experience the passage of being time and hear the utterance of its truth because you learn only that time is something that goes past. You fail to experience the passage of being time and hear the utterance of its truth, because you learn only that time is something that goes past. So unpacking that a little bit, this translation of Uji as being time, we can think of that as Dogen's shorthand for interdependent co-arising, or you might say for the way in which all things are created momentarily in each instant, or destroyed actually in each instant, right? So thinking of each instant as like a crescendo in a symphony made up of hundreds of notes occurring in a specific way in that moment. So this is the being, this is the meaning of that being time. And that's happening all the time, and it's happening and changing so swiftly that we don't even really call it the moment now. Because already to say now is past. What we're labeling as now is past. So Dogen used this term being time, that existence, so to speak, momentary existence is arising as a function, actually, of time. The other word that he uses in this statement is passage. So what do we mean by passage? One way to think about Dogen's use of this term passage is our perception of the fact that things change, our perceptions of impermanence, right? So we do have the feeling that things progress from the past to the present to the future. We have the feeling of first there's firewood, and then there's fire, and then there's ash. But the way that we know that, the way that we think of that as a progression, is because we notice the change from moment to moment. Right, we can notice the change in the firewood becoming ash. So this is our sense of passage. So again, in Dogen's comment, what he says is, you don't really experience the passage of being time and hear the truth that it's communicating. So what is the truth that it's communicating? This passage, this sense of impermanence and arising in the instant. So oftentimes these two teachings go together. This teaching of impermanence also means interconnectedness, means that all things are related to one another, that they cannot actually even momentarily arise without the arising of other. So this is the truth that's being expressed in being time and in its passage, in the fact that things change. Things change because other things change. So when we lose track of that, when we lose track of our interconnectedness, our relatedness to all the things that are happening around us in any given instant, then we only feel that things are going past. We only feel this losing of something or this pressure of the time, rather than experiencing the actual arising of this moment, the actual way in which we're connected to it. So what Dogen is really pointing at here is the fact that we live only in the moment. Much as we might like to think about the future and where we need to be in the next moment. So, and this moment is expressing this truth of interrelatedness, this truth of interconnectedness, this truth that we are actors in our world, right? That we are also creating those conditions, relating to those conditions from moment to moment. And the result of that then brings an effect in the next moment. So all of this is to say that your experience, actually, of time could be entirely different. You could choose to turn that thought of not having time into a helper in your life, into another perspective. You could see not having time, the idea of not having time, as a tool for really discerning what's skillful in your life. And by skillful, I mean what's harmonious with your interconnectedness, what's harmonious with the impermanence of life, the fact that things change, the fact that things are related to one another, that you are related to all the things in your environment. So you could have a shift that enables you to live a little bit more in the moment, with all its results of the past and all its possibilities of the future. And sometimes, I work as a hospice chaplain, sometimes what I notice is that when people have a shock in their lives, that they might suddenly be able to make this shift very quickly. Sometimes people are diagnosed with a terminal illness, and then they come to some realization about how precious life is, about being thoughtful in the way that they live. And in fact, for some people, there's a deep sense of sadness that arises, like they've been putting off all of these things, thinking about time in a different way. Or there are different types of shocks that can happen in life. There's a young Afghani woman, and I'm going to apologize in advance if I mispronounce names, but I believe that her name is pronounced Malala Yousafzai. She's an Afghani woman, young woman who was advocating for education for young girls in Afghanistan and was shot in the head, actually, by someone who disagreed with her. And you guys might have heard about her in the news. It's been several months now, if not more than that, maybe over a year now. But she survived. She survived that attack, and she actually continued to advocate for women's education in Afghanistan. And she actually had the opportunity to speak in front of the United Nations. An amazing thing for a young teen. I think she's in her teens at the time that that happened. And here's what she said about that event. She said, "Nothing has changed except fear and hopelessness have died." Nothing has changed except that fear and hopelessness has died. So imagine that. So imagine turning a situation that must have been incredibly scary, fearful, traumatic, painful, and turning that. We call that, one way to call that, is turning on the basis. Right, this is a teaching of turning our perspective, shifting our view, particularly fixed views, toward a more skillful way, toward a way that is in keeping with the truth, the reality of our lives. So some of you might have experienced these kinds of things in your lives, yourselves. But even if you haven't, you don't have to wait for that moment. You don't have to wait for some very difficult event in your life in order to really begin changing your perspective on not having time. You could just simply turn and begin a practice of acceptance of what's in the moment, Not acceptance, Pollyanna, like everything's cool, everything's okay. That's not what we mean by acceptance in Buddhism. It's typically more like acceptance of reality, clear seeing of what is actually happening. Because unless we start from a place of clearly seeing and accepting the reality, then we can't really respond. So, having acceptance, discernment using the precepts as a tool, using wisdom as a tool, compassion as an instrument of understanding, of really looking at our lives, and skillful response. Perhaps no response is also a skillful response, but discerning a skillful response to what's happening in the moment, clearly in the moment, holding it up to the light of Dharma, making a conscious choice, and responding rather than reacting. So for example, you could say, I don't have time for that worry about the future. Or you could say, I don't have time to watch violence for the sake of entertainment. Or I don't have time to be angry with that person who just jostled me on the sidewalk. So with a bit of a twist, you can begin to open up some new potential for presence, for patience, for letting go of a one-sided view. So another example I want to bring up briefly is this koan of the one who is not busy. I know that some of you have been studying koans a bit. It's case 21 from the Book of Serenity. And it involves a couple of actors that are very familiar. But before that, I want to say, so koan is a word that means a public case, or you might think of it in English more as like precedent, the way we use the word precedent. And thinking about these stories from the past, from the ancient Chinese past, as illuminating some truth, as demonstrating something. So this in the story of the one who is not busy, we have Yunyan, and again, I'm really awful with Chinese names, so please bear with me if I'm offending your ears. We have Yunyan, who is doing the sweeping, and we have Daowu, who is observing his Dharma brother doing the sweeping. And these two were Dharma brothers. They had practiced together for many years at several different monasteries, actually. They had originally studied with Baizhang, and then this story is said to have taken place with Master Yaoshang. And it happened, I don't know if I mentioned this already, it happened around 800 AD, would be when this particular conversation is said to have taken place, and written down sometime after that in the Song era in China, centuries after that. So the story is that Yunyan is sweeping, just an average, typical daily kind of thing to do. He's sweeping some part of the monastery there where they live. And his brother Daowu sees him sweeping and says, "Too busy." And Yunyan says, "You should know that there is one who is not busy." And Daowu says, "Is there a second moon? Is that so? Is there a second moon?" Or sometimes it's translated as a statement. "If that's so, then there is a second moon." So Yunyan responds by holding up the broom. Holding up the broom by its handle and saying, which moon is this? Which moon is this? So it's kind of it starts out with a kind of funny dialogue, right? You can imagine these two as Dharma brothers, and one kind of poking the other one, like, hey, you look like you're too busy. What's going on, you know? And it's a little bit of a judgment there, right? It feels like he's saying something of a judgment about his Dharma brother there. And yet, what Yunyan responds is, there is one who is not busy. Meaning, even within great activity, there is a stillness. You know, sometimes it can be helpful for us to try to slow down in life, walk more slowly, speak more slowly, drive more slowly. And yet there is also a practice that says, where do we find the stillness within the busy activity? Because sometimes you do need to move fast. You know, I think of the hummingbird as a lovely example. Right? It's okay to love speed, but find the stillness in it. Rest in the stillness in it. So that's how Yunyan responds to Daowu. And Daowu then says, is there a second moon? Meaning, is it really possible to separate this one who is not busy from the one who is busy? Right? So again, pointing back to this union, that this activity of creation in each moment is itself also completely demonstrating the perfect original function. There's nothing extra about it. There's nothing too busy about it. So in agreement, you might say, his brother holds up the broom and says, which moon is this? So again, each and every object in our lives as a complete expression of this interdependent arising, and our relationship to that object also involved in that complete expression of our interrelationship and that constant change. So turning it that way, we might see that these two brothers, Dharma brothers, are communicating the same understanding, are communicating this one way. This is what Dogen would call practice realization. That the perfection is inherent within the mundane. So Wansong, who is the person who compiled the Book of Serenity and made various commentaries on the koans therein, has this to say about the koan of the one who is not busy. He says, he has this recommendation for all of us. Good people, as you eat and boil tea and sweep, you should recognize the one who is not busy. Then you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. So it's not just about sweeping or about trying to find your keys, or about what to do when you're diagnosed with a terminal illness. it's more accessible than that, actually. Because it's right here in this moment. It cannot be any place other than in this moment. And in a funny way, you know, this is why we do so many ceremonies in Zen. We have all these rituals. You know, there was, for a long time when Zen first came to America, there was this idea that Zen completely rejects all formality. And yet, if you practice it at all, I think we know that actually there's quite a bit of formality and structure that's possible within the practice, that's typical within the practice. And so this is called entering through form or joining through form. There's a phrase, kata kara hairu. So kata is this word that means form or the way in which things are done. And kara means through or from. And hairu is a verb which is really fascinating, which means to join with or to enter. And it also has a sense of acceptance. So how is it that we are joining with form in our lives? Sometimes we use very fancy ceremonies and lots of incense and bowing. In other ways, one of the great teachings of Dogen is that all of the various activities of our lives are this way, right? There's sweeping and brushing our teeth and cooking, right? He wrote an entire fascicle about great teachings of cooking. Sometimes we might use a gatha, we might use a verse to help remind us of the symbolism that's inherent in a particular daily activity. So, for example, Dhanatasahara at the monastery and retreat center, there is this this verse that is at the bathhouse, and we say, and it's up here actually also in the bathroom, we say, bathing the body, may all living beings be clean in body and mind, pure and shining within and without. Not just talking about dirt that gets under your fingernails. Right. Clean in body and mind. Pure in body and mind. Already, inherently. Thich Nhat Hanh uses this this practice of taking three breaths when the phone rings. Or I have a friend who does three breaths before answering the next text. And one of my favorite examples of ritual is Mr. Rogers. So it's an American cultural reference, and for folks who might not be familiar with it, Mr. Rogers is a television show for children. I don't think it's on the air anymore, right? Hasn't been for decades, probably. But he would come and he would tell stories about this very fantastical land that was accessible by this little train in his home. And Mr. Rogers would come into the home, and this was part of the show. Every time there's this little music playing in the background, and you see him come into the home and sit down and change his shoes and put on his sweater. And he would do it every time the same way. And for me, it's kind of a ritual. It's Mr. Rogers' ritual about his shoes, you know, in the monastery as well. You know, when I practiced at the monastery in Japan, you could walk into the Buddha Hall, and the Buddha Hall was actually the main entrance for most of the folks who would come from outside the temple for ceremonies and such. And there'd just be rows and rows and rows of little pairs of shoes just perfectly lined up there. And I asked my Dharma sister, the senior nun there at the temple, why she would get irritated when people didn't put their shoes in a row. And she said, it's just laziness. And she's right. It is a form of laziness to think about just tossing your shoes off. And I think there's also something more there, you know. I think there's a way in which we can find some resonance with the order of our life by finding, by being in harmony with it, by being present with those things, those objects, in a way that really recognizes how precious they are because of how precious we are and how precious all things are. So there is a practice of Mr. Rogers shoes and Mr. Rogers sweater. So these are simply ways of really joining with form or entering into the real meaning of our life through form. And you might find some ways of your own. And I encourage you to think about that the next time that you feel too busy, the next time you think, I don't have time for that. What is that? Is it really something you don't have time for? What is it that's arising in this moment? What is it that arising is teaching you about the nature of suffering and the nature of liberation from suffering? So a friend of mine, Carla Antonaccio, who's a priest down at Chapel Hill Zen Center, when we were talking about this, said, you know, in Zen, you are an eternity. So I want to remind you all that you are an eternity. Thank you for listening today. I'm happy to take some questions or comments. Yes.
Yes, thank you for coming and giving this talk again. And thank you for bringing up Mr. Rogers. I realized when I was a kid, I think the sweater and the shoe part was my favorite part, which I probably should have known something was a little different from that. But looking back at it, I remember all the fantastical world and the trolley and where it would visit. But I remember always finding more comfort just in that beginning, opening segment.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It was a nice quick memory there. I hadn't thought about it in a long time, so.
Yeah, thank you. Did you have a question? That's your comment?
No, that's
okay. I don't know if you all could hear that Joseph said that he was grateful for hearing a little something about Mr. Rogers because it reminded him of how much he enjoyed that aspect of the little opening of the show and the ritual of Mr. Rogers changing his shoes and putting his sweater on. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the phrase, was it turning on the basis?
Yes, turning on the basis.
And the basis is?
The Dharma, the teachings of impermanence and interconnectedness, which are all related.
And so, yeah. And the turning is turning your mind toward it for your attention?
Exactly, turning your mind toward it, turning your actions in harmony with it, right? So really trying to find the way in which you can be in accord, have a life that's in accord with the fact that things do change and that things are connected to you, people are connected to you. Mm. Yeah.
I was interested in chaplain work. I wondered if you wanted to relate what you were saying in the other parts of your talk. listening to one, you're busy at the same time, and when you can't find your keys and so on, to what you learned from the chaplain work.
My experience of hospice is that, and that's a particular aspect of chaplaincy, clearly, not the whole body of it, but that's the one that I'm currently engaged in. And my experience of hospice is that folks who are able to see themselves as living up until the moment that they're dead and fully engaged in that living, then they can really have a spacious and peaceful and sometimes even joyful experience of these days, even in with the prospect of incredible decline in the body. People who are completely bedbound, you know. I'm so often reminded of the fact that we are whole beings even when our bodies aren't working real well. So for me, that's where those two things really meet up. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
So is there any form to the experience that you were just relating about people who are near death, in turning of the mind form that you've observed?
A form that people who are near death... Well, you know, people have many beliefs about what's going to happen after they die. And that has a big impact on what kind of form might be helpful for them, right? So if people have a great faith in going to heaven and seeing their family members in heaven, then there would be forms about, let's say, forgiveness that could be helpful to them, you know, that might help them feel like they've put some things behind them and they could just go through this journey with some ease, right? Or if you have a belief in rebirth, you know, like a Tibetan practice, for example, where people would have a belief in a certain kind of passage, then there are forms that are helpful with that. But as a general rule, I don't think any form is really necessary. I think it's more about, it's more about like really understanding that we can meet our life in this moment, no matter what else is happening. No.
So, getting back to Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
When he says, "Won't you be my neighbor?" every time he always concluded, is that a bit of a form inviting us into his world there?
Sure. Anything. I mean, you could say that ritual is. In fact, I'm giving a class on ritual that starts June 24th over at City Center. You could say that ritual is really any kind of activity that we do repeatedly with a particular procedure that has, and in particular religious ritual, has a symbolic meaning, right? But I think what Dogen said was, you don't need religion for ritual and for all of life to actually have a symbolic meaning, right? We are expressions of Buddha nature. Right? Not we have Buddha nature. This is the big shift, the big philosophical shift that Dogen made by his translation of the old Chinese text. We are Buddha nature. So we are a manifestation of that inherent perfection of activity, of loss and gain or arising. So how is it that we can actually manifest that, right? We're manifesting that in our lives, and yet we're kind of really not aware of it. So then what we do is we add on these sorts of rituals, these activities, right? Or we add on a layer of attention, maybe, like to the way that we put our shoes, on in an effort to really find that resonance again, right? To really find that resonance again. Because we're already intimate with it, but we lose track of that in our just state of business, in our state of thinking about other things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes?
Maybe I might have just answered the question, but I was just wondering if you could talk about the practice of Bhaktivedanta when you said, I don't have time to worry, or I don't have time to be angry at the person who bumps into me. And I was just wondering how you kind of create that shift in your ordinary life.
I think it has a lot to do with comparing mind. You know, worry in particular, I think, has a lot to do with comparing mind. Like, I want the future to be like a particular way, and then I spend a lot of time worrying about whether it's going to be a particular way, right? So there's a difference. I want to make the distinction between that and saying we have a hope or we have an intention for our lives. Right, because that's a wholesome activity, to say that we want to have a particular event happen. Right, you sit down, you plan a vacation, and then hopefully you get to that place that you're planning to vacation. Right, and if we hold that with a mind of gripping, with a mind of fixed view, with a mind of, you know, fear about the fact that things are changing and that things aren't going to really exactly line up with our plan, then that creates worry right there. Right? Because the fact is, things aren't going to happen the way you plan them, 100%. It's just not possible. Right? That's the nature of change. But to the extent that we're fearful of that, then we really create a lot of suffering about it. Whereas if we can accept that and start from that standpoint of, okay, you know, this is the plan, and some things might change, or some things might not go according to plan, and I learn to have confidence, I learn to have some trust, I learn to have some sense of being able to flow with that, right? There's a Sanskrit term called shraddha, which is a sense of confidence in the Dharma being in your life, in the way that function can be skillful. So developing a little bit of that, resting, abiding in that, instead of in fear. Mm-hmm. I don't have a watch on, folks, so I don't know what time it is. How are we doing for time?
A little after 11.
Is it? Okay, well then, thank you so much.
May our intention be extended to every being.